the Harvard, the Berkman Center. Then if you've not read his work, you should leave this room right now and go and read it. Or maybe you want to wait maybe 45 minutes. Yochai, are you here? There you go. Yochai's going to talk to us about what it means for open video to be radically decentralized and what the implications for that are for free speech, for justice, for democracy, etc. One of the things that we see in the longest of sponsors and partner organizations is this movement is a movement from the bottom up. And I think things are starting to shift. We're starting to see the movement change. Yochai's going to talk to us about where this could take us. Take it away, Yochai.
It's great to be here. I have to say, one of the great prides of a teacher is to see so many students going out in the world and actually doing things. And there are many here, and it's very moving. So I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm thrilled to spend a little bit of time talking about why now, looking at an open video alliance, looking at an open video as a concept, it really brings together something that has happened in many other dimensions and began perhaps most forcefully or most visibly in software and moved text to Wikipedia as the ultimate symbol. And now really is moving into this rich and immersive space of video. So essentially what we're talking about is democracy and innovation. By anyone, for anyone, anywhere, by everyone, for everyone, again, anywhere. The critical point is not necessarily market or non-market. It's not necessarily even legal or illegal, mainstream or fringe, but really the possibility of anyone to be effective in their ability to express themselves and communicate with others, to be creative, to intervene in culture, but also in the context of developing platforms to innovate. And it's this combination of both the democratization, both in politics and in, I'm sorry, just someone said familiar faces. In terms of democracy, but also in terms of innovation and insights coming together. So that's what I'm going to try to focus on. The background that needs to be understood is that when we use the term information economy as equivalent to post-industrial economy, we were making a mistake. There was an industrial information economy from the middle of the 19th century, which was organized around the same principle. It was expensive to communicate information to all of the size of the audience increased with transportation and first nationalization and later globalization. And to reach the relevant human community that anybody would want to talk to was very expensive. First with mechanical presses and folding machines, then with large radio towers, television, mainframe, satellite. The core organizing principle was that you needed high capitalization in order to be effective. Just like you could be a hobbyist and build cars on the weekend, but were constrained from communicating by the cost of an assembly line, so too, you could be a hobbyist, communicator, creator on the weekend, but the cost of effective communication and production of something that could really be communicated around was very high. What we see in the networked information economy is a radical decentralization of the physical capital necessary to communicate, store, and process information, as well as to capture and store it. These are these machines, and all of the other little video machines that we're holding at me as we're talking. The physical capital for communication, computation, storage, sensing, and capture is widely distributed in the population. And at the same time, the human capabilities that are absolutely central to what it is to be creative and innovative themselves are also widely distributed in the population. Creativity, wisdom, insight, perspective. We think of genius as something unique. We understate the importance of perspective, of simply having had the life experience that makes you look at something in a certain way that's different from how other people see it and then can teach it. Presence, just being in all sorts of places, and socialization. One of the things that we're seeing is that things are not purely distributed just one-to-one, but that people get organized. And instead of getting organized around contact and organizational systems that are formal, the core organizing principle are the set of basic socialization skills that we have that allow us to work with each other as human beings. So this is true on a very broad scale. The most important inputs into the core economic activities of the most advanced economies are now widely distributed in the population. About 1 billion people on the planet have these basic needs. Once you actually start looking at mobile phones, which are central to video, you're talking about much larger numbers. What that does is it takes the thing that we normally do and have always done as social beings with each other, saying hello, giving instructions on the street to somebody who needs, telling a joke, moving them from being central to society and peripheral to the economy to becoming integral to the core activities of the wealthiest nations as well as everywhere else in the world. From the perspective of innovation, creativity, and insight, the critical fact is that distributed action provides distributed possibilities for sensing the possibility to act, identifying new problems, trying new solutions, diagnosing whether they work or not, communicating them again, so that you have millions of people looking at problems from different perspectives. And the problems can be describing the Iranian revolution as it goes on now, or the problem can be solving a bug to a piece of software. It doesn't matter. You have different people located in a very distributed way looking at the questions and trying to find solutions. And increasingly what we see even in innovation studies is that people like Eric von Hippel, who for 20 years have been talking about user innovation and about mountain bikes, suddenly become people who saw things well in advance when they said innovation doesn't come from the company and its R&D, innovation comes from a network of connected people, some inside companies, some outside, some in the market, some outside of the market, all working together on little bits and pieces around an open innovation system that allows anyone to say, I've identified a project, I have an idea, I can do something useful. Here, isn't it cool? You do it too. What this does is it allows faster learning and innovation. And this was the first thing people realized before understanding the effects on democracy, I think, what became very generalized was the rate of innovation was increasing because the pressure from globalization and innovation is such that without increasing the speed of innovation and learning, companies, countries, find themselves stagnant. And so the fact that you can harness so many people with so many different perspectives and opportunities to learn became an absolutely central competitive necessity. What it means is that the right person with the right skills, whether or not they're working in the same company that owns a given resource, can come up with a solution. More important in some senses for us here is that you get a more participatory culture. And while not utopia, certainly a more democratic public sphere in terms of who can participate. So let me try to work through this with a few details. But the core idea, both on the side of innovation and on the side of political democracy and cultural democracy, is that human creativity in loosely coupled systems moves to the core at the expense of more structured and controlled production. The core threat of Wikipedia to Britannica was not free, it was authority. It was the fact that ownership and control was not the sine qua non of authority. You did not need to have ownership and control in order to generate authority. Authority could be generated through a process of conversation and testing and trying again and correcting over time as a process rather than a reference to a point of authority. the authority to act and the authority to accredit. What this allows is for this new kind of democracy to be based in autonomy, the autonomy to act, alone and in loose association with others. It allows for a more transparent culture because we see what went into the creation. We know who created it and how, and what the process was that created it. A more diverse culture because you can have not everyone as a practical matter because there are skills barriers for sure, but a much larger set of people able to express themselves, and maybe a more critical and self-reflective and participatory culture that we're beginning to see as people become creators. They become better leaders. They see what goes into something and they can question, why did this go here? Why did that go here? Good writers can be good critical leaders. Good video communicators and creators can be good video leaders. So if we look at political democracy, the core effect that I see, one core effect, is the creation of the fifth estate. People once used to talk about the fifth estate as the mainstream media, electronic media relative to newspapers. But really, you can think of the mainstream media perhaps as the fourth estate. But the fifth estate is the fact that people are around everywhere with their devices, capable of capturing and saying, I was there, here's what happened. So we're all now, aren't we, looking at these images. I'm not getting the sound for some reason. Forget is the raw presence of humanity everywhere to capture what it suffers and what it sees and communicate it around the world. This is a major source of potential visibility. The other thing that you get is this kind of, I was there, I can show you. So this is continuing on the Iran theme, but somewhat different. Former presidential candidate John McCain's solution to relations with Iran with appropriate gravity. Gives us some opportunity for opinion. And in addition, expressing ourselves in all sorts of ways that are very effective and powerful in ways that are quite different from writing a piece of text. The classic legal moment in this is a case called Cohen versus California, where the Supreme Court was responding to a particular jacket that led to the statement, one man's vulgarity is another man's lyric, and this was a protester with a jacket that said, fuck the draft. Well, it's not the same to save in text and to save in video. So what do we have here? Express opinion and connect with emotion and identify things that are happening in a way that isn't there in text, but is a real replacement and a real alternative to what we understood to be the authoritative source that came out of the proprietary system. The second major anchor or arm of what we care about when we care about democracy is cultural democracy, the ability to actually participate in what goes on in culture. Part of it is about definition. So an example there, I guess I didn't wind it up properly, sorry. So this, I take it, is about to become operational fairly soon, this kind of arrangement. Where are we? So the nice thing I like about this, other than that it's in New York and therefore here is the right place to start showing it. Hello? Yeah, it was working quite lovely for 10 minutes ago. In the nature of the beast, isn't it? Oh well, you'll believe me. That the nice thing about this is that people are able to capture their own images of Tompkins Square Park and project it together. I'm sure the demo will work better when you show it later. The ability of people to actually say, here's my Tompkins Square Park. Here's what I see that's beautiful and special about it. And of course, what we're seeing also is a more participatory set of cultural practices as artists and fans start to exchange. So somebody like Jonathan Colton, who gives his music out freely and is able to allow users to say, here, create your own videos. Let's load them up here. Let's create a connection where we're creating something together, and I value your creativity while you value mine, instead of going out and suing fans, creating much tighter connections. As I said, the second central thing that I think is important for this alliance is the idea of distributed innovation. If the smartest, most creative people with the most pertinent experience in intuitional associations with present problems and solutions never work in the same company, never work in the same nonprofit. They're always in different places. So the critical question is, how do you build a platform that allows all of these people to bring to bear the right insight, the right experience, the right creativity for the same set of questions? And that's what open innovation platforms allow. They allow innovation to speed up and improve by allowing different people in different settings and organizations to innovate on the state of the art without asking anyone's permission. That means the commons, first and foremost. There's no requirement, may I please innovate, to retard or prohibit innovations. I have an idea, I can go and do this. And what you get is a proprietary regime trades control and a particularly crisply understood set of incentives for the ability to draw lots and lots of people to say, I have an idea, versus the other way around. What we see from repeated empirical evidence over 25, close to 30 years now, is that in the vast majority of industries, really outside of pharmaceuticals, Hollywood, and the recording industry, that trade-off is a false one. So you see IBM moving from being in 1984 part of the same alliance that pushed for the World Intellectual Property Organization and the WTO TRIPS agreement for strong IP globally, to suddenly being part of what backs, part of the backing for the Free Software Foundation, much more on a services model, much less on a proprietary model. Understanding that even on the industry side, it's not in the interest of most companies in most sectors to be proprietary and controlling relative to negotiating. So this is, sort of, for example, backers of the Free Software Foundation, but also the marquee list that Shai was describing earlier for this event, again shows you the critical thing is, it's not an opposition between market and non-market. It's an alliance between market and non-market, government and non-government, for-profit and decentralized individual, people and groups and networks of people who understand themselves as not being in the business of controlling, but being in conversation with others, both on the substance of what we care about and on how to get there in the most innovative way. Needless to say, there are others who do see the benefits of that side of the debate. And we see a battle over the institutional environment. Control over the physical pipes, like for example, the concern that web-based video will compete with traditional channels where cable companies know exactly how to make their money. Control over logical platforms or tools that can constrain creativity. There are companies who see their particular objective is identifying a particular tool that they can then capture and control the market. And then there are the other alternative that says, let's all innovate on a set of tools, and then those who want to make money will make money on services or whatever else they do without controlling. Those who want to fulfill a nonprofit role will fulfill a nonprofit role. Those who want to have fun, but will have a core common set of the most advanced tools possible. And the major clash, obviously, is the existing cultural materials that are the raw material of what we use in order to create new materials. Leonard Bernstein used Romeo and Juliet for West Side Story, and all of us do it all the time. And the question of copyright is critically a question of government regulating the particular modality of creativity. Its effect is ambiguous on incentives. Its effect is clear on the choice between open, non-proprietary approaches, both commercial and non-commercial, to creating and sustaining creativity versus proprietary control-based systems. And the stronger the copyright is, the stronger the government is basically saying, we prefer Hollywood and the recording industry over creators who are using different strategies to keep art and soul together. The last thing that I want to talk about are standards. Again, standards are another form of potential constraint on behaviors. Well-specified, open to all, common, codified elements that anybody can use and form the boundaries between different implemented approaches. Classic ones, obviously, TCP/IP, HTML, XML, etc. The critical point is, unlike with intellectual property where you say, I'm not allowed to innovate because I don't have the right. Here, I can't practically innovate because I need access to something that's on your side of the organizational boundary. You need to change something, and I need your agreement. As long as we have standard interfaces that nobody needs to ask anyone's permission, as long as they comply with the interface, again, what you have is authority to act, located where the capacity to act is without having to ask permission from someone else. So distributed innovation depends on commons and on open standards to locate authority and capacity to act at the edges of the network, where anyone can undertake both a creative moment and an innovative moment, and then contribute it to the common. So this is the suggestion, that human creativity and loosely coupled people, having moved to the core at the expense of more structured production, can in fact lead to a more democratic public sphere, both cultural and political, and potentially to a faster innovation environment. But it is under threat from and threatens 20th century industrial models and their tightly bound organization and legal systems of control. So these are the battles we see in telecoms, in copyright, in various para-copyright. We've seen over the last decade and a half pushback, both legal and political. We've seen the free culture movement, which has such strong showing here. We've seen the ATK movement, the access to knowledge movement. And most importantly, we're seeing a social cultural change where people no longer think that the only thing to do with a movie is to go to watch a movie. People can begin to create themselves, and we see that as a central part of how they understand themselves and how they understand what they can do. So we're seeing now an alliance beginning to see. So here's the Computer and Communications Industry Association coming out with a report that says that fair use industries accounted for 16.6% of US GDP growth in 2006, 4.5 trillion revenues. True or untrue, what this is an image of politics. What this is an image of rising political power and political alliance between the for-profit and the non-profit, at least in segments that understand the same set of issues. These are the annual revenues of industries represented in the Grokster case. These are against Grokster, these are for. To the extent that you believe in the power of money in American politics, this is an optimistic picture. We're seeing the development of hacks like Creative Commons, like efforts by documentary filmmakers to begin to create social standards. What's the norm? And to really formalize around them so as to expand the boundaries of fair use by coming together and saying, here are the 10 things we often do, and you know what? Sue us if those are not fair use, but we're together saying these are the common practice now. So the core question is, can we create a new social cultural space in the overlap of market and social relations? Can we construct these spaces as sustainable social cultural systems that are not based on control, authority, and ownership, but on social and cooperative models? And essentially, if I were to say in one word what I see is so exciting about this diverse array of people and organizations that are here in this room today, it's the possibility of coming together on a common set of platforms and a common set of policy positions that together will enable distributed innovation for distributed creativity. Thank you.